Welcome to the Students of Surgery podcast series, where we shed light on common surgical topics.
Hello, I am Folakemi Olaoken. I'm a final year medical student at the University of Pretoria, and with me is...
Hi, my name is Aradezi Ramuntaka, and I'm also a final year medical student at the University of Pretoria.
And this is the Students of Surgery podcast series. Hi, Prof. What is the topic today?
So, hi, guys. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about uncomplicated peptic ulcer disease.
Prof, what is peptic ulcer disease?
So, simply stated, peptic ulcers refers to acid causing damage to the gastroduodenal mucosa. And what this results in is that the mucosal erosion exposes the underlying layers of the wall to the digestive action of gastroduodenal secretions, but specifically gastric acid.
What causes peptic ulcer disease?
So traditionally, it was always related to a hypersecretory acid environment, there were dietary factors, and there was stress. However, nowadays, the increasing incidence of Helicobacter pylori infection and extensive use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, together with the increased use of alcohol and smoking, has changed the epidemiology of the disease to these factors.
Can you please explain a little bit of the pathophysiology of this condition?
Several environmental and host factors contribute to ulcer formation by increasing gastric acid secretion or weakening of the defensive mucosal barrier. Among environmental factors, smoking, excessive alcohol use, and drug use are probably the most often quoted. None of them, apart from non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug use or NSAIDs, have been identified as individual ulcerogenic agents. Although stress cannot be neglected as a contributing factor, there is no convincing evidence that it is the sole cause of ulcers. The definition of a stress ulcer, however, should be restricted to bleeding ulcers in the context of severe organic illnesses, such as patients who've had acute cerebral trauma, acute burns, and sepsis with multiple organ failure in intensive care units. On the other hand, epidemiology studies repeatedly have shown a very strong association between H. pylori infection and duodenal and gastric ulcers. It is estimated that more than 50% of the world's population have a chronic H. pylori infection of the gastric mucosa. However, only 5 to 10% of these patients will develop ulcers because of the H. pylori. NSAIDs damage the stomach mainly by suppression of gastric prostaglandin synthesis. Hence, selective inhibition of COX-2 reduces but does not eliminate the risk of gastroduodenal ulcers and their complications. Importantly, the use of low-dose aspirin increases the risk of ulcer bleeding by 2 to 3 times compared with non-aspirin users. This risk is thought to be more because of the antiplatelet effect perpetuating a bleed as to actually causing mucosal damage of an ulcer.
So now that we have defined peptic ulcers and briefly on the pathophysiology of the condition, what are the complications of peptic ulcer disease?
So bleeding and perforation are the most common acute complications, with perforation being rarer than bleeding, and the perforation to bleeding ratio is about 1 to 6. However, perforation is the most common indication for an emergency surgery and causes about 40% of all ulcer-related deaths. Gastric outlet obstruction very rarely in the acute situation is secondary to edema caused by the acute peptic ulcer disease process. And more commonly, gastric outlet obstruction occurs because of chronic fibrosis. However, this is also very rare nowadays due to the very effective medical treatment that we have available to us. And in a patient nowadays who does develop a gastric outlet obstruction, one must be very suspicious of an underlying malignancy and must go all out to rule out that this patient has a gastric cancer.
So, how do patients with uncomplicated peptic ulcer disease usually present?
Their predominant symptom is usually epigastric pain, which may be accompanied by other dyspeptic symptoms such as fullness, bloating, early satiety, and also nausea. Approximately a third of these patients will also complain of heartburn or gastroesophageal reflux disease. In patients with a duodenal ulcer, epigastric pain typically occurs during a fasting state or at night. It is usually relieved by food, and it can obviously be relieved by acid neutralizing agents.
I think now the question on everyone's mind is, are there any clinical signs that one should look out?
Yeah, there are always signs to look out for, but unfortunately there are no pathognomonic features of uncomplicated peptic ulcer disease. With a general examination, one should always look for signs of anemia and cervical lymphadenopathy, and here we're specifically talking about Virchow's lymph node, which is sited in the left supraclavicular fossa, and this would obviously be a sign of underlying malignancy. With abdominal examination, there's usually very little to demonstrate, except maybe eliciting pain with deep epigastric palpation.
Now that we know the clinical presentation and signs of peptic ulcer disease, how do you make a definitive diagnosis?
So in young patients, and young here is defined as those who are less than 55 years of age, who have ulcer-like symptoms and an absence of alarm symptoms, a test and treat strategy can be used. If the breath test or stool antigen test is not available, or there are alarm symptoms, or the patient is older than 55 years of age, an upper endoscopy should be performed.
You mentioned the test and treat strategy now. Can you please tell us a little bit about it?
So this refers to a non-invasive management of these patients. In other words, one does not do an upper endoscopy. So how do we test for H. pylori in these patients? Well, as we said, it's non-invasive. So the most common two tests that we use here is radio-labeled a urea breath test, or one can do a stool antigen test. And if either of these are positive, one can then treat the patient for H. pylori and eradicate them. The rationale for this test and treat strategy: in a proportion of patients, their symptoms will be due to an underlying ulcer disease that can be cured just by H. pylori, and they do not require an invasive endoscopy. Very importantly, the alarm symptoms such as loss of appetite, loss of weight, anemia, and vomiting must be excluded, and you must document it as such. If any of these symptoms are present, there may be complicated peptic ulcer disease or an underlying malignancy, and one must do an endoscopy in these patients.
On an endoscopy, how would we diagnose a peptic ulcer disease?
So a peptic ulcer is defined when there's a break in mucosa with a diameter greater than 5 millimeters. It is usually covered with fibrin. A mucosal break that is less than half a centimeter in diameter is called an erosion. These can be single or they can be multiple. The most common site for peptic ulcer disease is in the duodenal bulb, or in the first part of the duodenum immediately after the pylorus. This is where the gastric acid secretions first come into contact with a small bowel mucosa. If ulceration is seen in more distal duodenum, then an underlying inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's disease, occult ischemia, or even a Zollinger-Ellison syndrome should be considered and excluded in these patients.
And where are gastric ulcers most commonly seen?
Gastric ulcers usually occur at the incisura on the lesser curve. However, they don't all read the textbook, and they can actually occur anywhere from the pylorus all the way up to the cardia.
So now we're performing endoscopy. Once an ulcer is seen at endoscopy, what should we do?
So the antigen body or the fundus mucosa should be biopsied for the detection of H. pylori. And then what we can do actually in the endoscopy room is do a rapid urease test. And it's always a good idea to send a sample off for histology, where they can look under the microscope and see the organisms as well. If there is any suspicion for a gastric ulcer that could be malignant, then the edges of the ulcer must be biopsied, and multiple biopsies should be taken.
But then how do we go about treating the patient who has symptomatic peptic ulcer disease?
Current ulcer therapy consists of H. pylori eradication in an H. pylori positive peptic ulcer and PPIs, so proton pump inhibitors, for healing, and if possible, preventing peptic ulcers induced by gastrotoxic drugs. There is a small role for using drugs which enhance mucosal resistance, such as bismuth and misoprostol.
So what would be the treatment of H. pylori positive ulcers?
So the aim is always eradication. So this is usually achieved with a combination of acid inhibiting therapy and antibiotics. For uncomplicated duodenal ulcers, a 10-day eradication therapy does not have to be followed by PPIs. This is different as to gastric ulcers, as gastric ulcers must have PPIs for about 8 weeks after completing the antibiotic regimen. In South Africa, we treat patients with clarithromycin 1 gram and amoxicillin 2 grams. Both are given BD per os, together with a standard dose of a proton pump inhibitor. If the patient has a penicillin allergy, we swap the amoxicillin with metronidazole 400 milligrams daily.
After the the treatment of H. pylori positive ulcers, do we need to confirm eradication?
Ideally, we should. In duodenal ulcers, if available, confirmation by non-invasive methods, again, that is your radio-labeled urea breath test or your stool antigen test, is sufficient to confirm healing. However, in patients with gastric ulcers, one should always try confirm healing endoscopy, and one should also do biopsies, even if the ulcer has healed, to exclude malignant disease.
If the patients weren't successfully treated, what can we give to the patient?
A PPI combined with amoxicillin and metronidazole are recommended as second-line therapy if the PPI clarithromycin and amoxicillin were used as the first-line therapy.
Many guidelines talk about adding bismuth. However, bismuth is not available in South Africa and is also not available in many other countries in the world. If the patient has a penicillin allergy, we would usually give them levofloxacin 500 mg BD instead of the amoxicillin.
So what if the peptic ulcer is caused by an NSAID use?
And especially because we've got such a high rate of H. pylori infection in our country, you must always make sure that there isn't a concomitant H. pylori infection in these patients as well. If there is, then eradication therapy is what's required. Provided that the NSAIDs are discontinued, in patients who develop uncomplicated peptic ulcer disease while on NSAIDs, most gastric or duodenal ulcers will heal with 8 weeks using just a standard dose of an histamine 2 receptor antagonist such as ranitidine 150 mg BD. If the NSAIDs cannot be stopped, then the patient requires either a change in the type of NSAIDs, so in other words you change them across into a COX-2 inhibitor if it's possible, and if it is not possible, the patient should be put onto a PPI while they are still using NSAIDs.
So we've talked about H. pylori and NSAID use being the causes of peptic ulcer disease. So what about H. pylori negative, NSAID negative ulcers?
So these are very, very rare. And often they're misdiagnoses. So a detailed and careful history of the use of NSAIDs and aspirin use must be done. Many patients in our country especially do not realize that they are taking NSAIDs. The most common culprit here would be that patients are taking Grandpa, which they can quite easily get over the counter, and they don't know that it actually is an NSAID. The next question has to be whether or not H. pylori test could be falsely negative, and whether or not one should go back and repeat the test and do a different test. If there's a high prevalence of H. pylori, then an antral and body mucosal biopsy should always be sent off for histology, because that's probably the most specific way of diagnosing H. pylori infection. Biopsy should also be taken of the ulcer to exclude an underlying malignancy, and here we should take multiple biopsies, not just one or two. If there are multiple ulcers or unusually sited ulcers, then diseases such as Zollinger-Ellison syndrome with its pathognomonic hypergastrinemia should be excluded.
Thank you so much, Prof. Do you have any closing remarks?
So peptic ulcer disease, especially uncomplicated disease, is very common. And once you get these kind of patients, look for the risk factors and see if you can modify them or even prevent them. Always look for the alarm symptoms, and if they are present, you must refer your patient urgently for an endoscopy. If there are no alarm symptoms, then one can always do a test and treat strategy. And keeping in mind that H. pylori infection, especially in South Africa, is very common, and we should ideally always try to confirm eradication of H. pylori.
This has been another podcast in the Students of Surgery series. If you found this podcast useful, why not listen to other episodes on this series as well? Until the next patient, keep reading, keep examining, and keep asking questions.
That was another edition of the Students of Surgery podcast series, where we shed light on common surgical topics.